I'm delighted to be back. It's always a joy. It's a second home for me, so it's a treat. It's a treat to be back here, even in the pathetic shape I'm in, not just my usual pathetic shape, but if my voice gives out, I have this head cold that I've had for months that just won't go away. And I've been complaining to everyone who would listen. So now that I have a captive audience, I'll complain to you as well. So I knew I was flying out early this morning, and I've had this cold, and I was tired, and I thought, so I'll be sensible, and I'll go to bed early. This was last night. And so I indeed went to bed early. I got all packed and actually had fallen asleep, and suddenly about 11:30 last night outside my window, jackhammers. And at first I thought I'd gone mad. And then I heard bulldozers. And I actually got up and looked outside, and there they were, out in the streets. And I remembered they're repaving all the streets of Annapolis, and they've decided to work at night. So from about 11:30 until 4:30 in the morning, jackhammers and bulldozers. So I got very little sleep, so if I should nod off at the podium, please forgive me. The curious thing, let me say this, I mean, it's funny in its way. At the same time, I think there is a connection in that as I was stomping around my apartment in the middle of the night in just a blind fury that this could be going on in a residential neighborhood where people have to get up and go to work in the morning. I mean, it did occur to me, it's just another example of everything turned upside down, everything gone mad. And instead of the night being a time for sleep, and when people can sleep and renew themselves because they have a day to get through when the sun comes up, they were out there under these blinding lights, working, keeping everyone else awake, and I'm sure that they then went to sleep at about 5 this morning. You know? It seems as if, day by day, moment by moment, everything gets crazier. It is something that most of us are familiar with now. But what I want to do tonight is talk about one of the first who perceived this, who perceived that disorder had replaced order, that death had replaced life, that everything had suddenly been inverted. It is one thing to have such a perception, and it's no small thing to have such a perception. It obviously is a gift. Those who possess vision are given vision as a gift. Many have eyes, but as we know, we're supposed to see with them. Very few do. Very few, even today, out there in that mayhem that constitutes the modern world, are aware that anything is wrong. I just read a little comment by the great G.K. Chesterton, who was talking about problems with the modern world, and he said, it's not that people aren't out there looking for a solution. It's that they don't know there's a problem, which is absolutely correct. There's not even the basic perception. How odd that Mr. Eliot, long, long ago, the poem printed in 1922, but obviously the result of years of perception. You can't write a poem like this whimsically overnight. It doesn't happen that way. There is depth of perception here, which means for years those eyes were seeing. He was seeing what others did not see. He turned it into thought, and then, and this is where talent comes in, and talent is a gift, particularly talent, the talent of a genius, to be able to give voice to it. And I want to make a claim tonight that Eliot was not just giving voice to what he saw for himself, but that as those few great poets throughout all of human history have done, he speaks for us. He speaks for a time. The great poets are our voices. We may see very few of us can speak so eloquently. And what a great poet does is not just to have the perception, but to have the ability to turn that perception into words that are thick with thought and expressed with extraordinary beauty. It only happens rarely. There's a lot of talent out there always. Talent seems to be given abundantly, although I do believe we're in a time when it's dried up. But it is true that any given age seems often to produce a poet who speaks for that age. The Greeks had Homer. The Romans had Virgil. In the Middle Ages, clearly Dante spoke for his age. As you know, to my mind, the Renaissance is Shakespeare. He gave voice to that time. He did it in poetry. And for us, for the modern age, Eliot is our poetic voice. There are other voices that speak for us in other ways, clearly. But they are often voices speaking in prose. They are giving us information. And the voice of the poet is something very different. So before I actually get to the poem, let me say a few words about poetry. And I want to do this because being Americans, as most of us are, we do not understand, we don't care for, and we certainly don't honor poetry. It is not accidental that the school where I teach, which is sending young men off to be leaders, to be naval officers, for the most part, for a good 70 to 80% of the student body, requires that after they take a basic English and history sequence their first year, only need take two humanities courses beyond that. As compared with somewhere in the neighborhood of 30 to 40 courses in science and engineering. Okay? They view that somehow as a proper balance. I would say that's an American balance. And what it says is, life can be solved by equations. You don't need to know history. And you certainly don't need that poetry stuff. It's not important. Ours is a scientific, technological, engineering country. We like politics, we like money, we like our entertainment fluffy and quick. And even then, we certainly don't want it expressed in anything like, and it's the word I hear over and over again, I love it. My students, if they start talking about poetry, automatically come out with two things. It's flowery. It's all that flowery stuff. I say, yeah, go read The Wasteland. It's real flowery stuff there. dead violets on a on a tombstone. And the other thing is it's got all that hidden meaning. Okay, it's just the notion that we read poetry with a shovel, and if we dig long enough, then maybe we might hit a little something down there, but usually it's not worth the effort, so why bother? Complete misperception of what poetry is and how it operates. So we don't teach it in our schools, we don't honor it, we don't understand it. Just very quickly, what is poetry? Well, it's the oldest of all the literary art forms. It's so old, we can't really trace how far back it goes. But we do know that if we go all the way back, we find poetry there. Which means at the very stirrings, at the very dawn of Western civilization, there has been the urge to write poetry, or speak poetry, or transmit that which was important through poetry. It can take various forms even way back in times gone by. Obviously, there are sections of the Bible that are poetic. The Psalms are among the greatest poems ever written. Extraordinary. We go all the way back to Homer and find two giant poems as different as the Iliad, the great poem about the Trojan War, or the Odyssey, the first great romance ever written. huge poems passed down for generations. And it, in that, actually both in the Psalms and in the dawn of Greek poetry with Homer, we get the first thing that poetry does and the reason poetry exists. Because back before there was paper or pencils or the printing press or books or you could go online, there had to be a way of remembering and transmitting. And poetry, first and foremost, is rhythmic speech. There's rhythm that drives it. And it wasn't accidental that people began thinking and trying to communicate rhythmically, because those rhythms stick in your mind. They allow you to remember. So that Homer's poem of thousands and thousands of lines was transmitted orally. You could simply, because of the rhythms, because of the sounds, listen to it often enough, get it in your own head, and you didn't have to have a copy of it. You could remember it. You could remember it, and it could be transmitted that way. That seems like something very foreign, very alien to us, and yet it still survives. There's a haunting passage in Solzhenitsyn's Gulag Archipelago, where he talks about being in the Soviet slave labor camp and realizing, number one, he had to keep his sanity. He feared for that his mind would go, and he had to keep mental discipline. And he decided to write a poem, to write an epic poem. And every day he wrote, and by wrote, I mean created in here. He didn't have paper, he didn't have pen. He didn't have floppy disks. Every day he created in here, he wrote 50 lines of this poem that he called Prussian Nights, about the pre-revolutionary Russia. And he'd memorized them. And then the next day, he'd write 50 more and keep it up here. And he was able to remember it by reciting it silently to himself. And by the time he was finished, by the time he finally got out of there, he had a 10,000-line poem up here, that he was then able to put down on paper. It's been published. Okay? Poetry is mental discipline. But I would also say, in that example, we get a sense of the source of poetry. Poetry comes from the soul. And in the slave labor camps, what Solzhenitsyn was trying to do was try to keep his soul alive. And one way of doing that was through beautiful words. And the beauty of the words could then be combined with those rhythms, those sounds that would allow him to keep it, to store it in his memory. And there was discipline. There was order. There was beauty. What poetry does is take the word, and I don't have to explain to you the implications of what that means or where it comes from, and treat the word, that is, the mundane language, seemingly mundane language with which we communicate, and treat it as something extraordinarily important that can convey essential truths, and that can do so with great beauty. And that if we put words together, if a master poet puts words together, it is not just the sense of what he's saying, it is the sound of what he's saying. And a poet is a musician. A poet is always a musician. But his instrument is the language. And a great poet is a superb musician who is able to use those words, hear them in combinations that are unforgettable, that strike some profound pulse in us, that somehow get to the core of who we are, what we're about, where we come from, why we're here, and where we're going, and through the word, not the ultimate great word of the gospel, which is the good news in words, but in other ways, about the world around us, about human beings, about how we live, about any given time, any given age, what was important, how we treated one another, how we thought, all of that permeating the poetry and conveying that in a way that I will call spiritual, because the difference between poetry and prose, I think, is finally as simple as this. Prose is the day-to-day language of the natural world in which we live, by which we convey information, simple information and facts. Poetry aspires toward the supernatural. Poetry elevates us. Poetry lifts us up and begins to open vistas onto things, that possibilities that we know are there. Poetry can be, because it is like music, one of those bridges between those two worlds in which we live, the natural and the supernatural. Now, basically, in some way, I don't want to make it sound too elevated, because when it comes down to it, poetry itself is innate and deep in us, and I would say almost biological. It is not accidental that 80% of the poetry written in English and a number of other languages, I'm speaking particularly the Romance languages, although we find it elsewhere, most of the rhythm of verse is iambic. It simply means an unaccented syllable followed by an accented syllable. Short, long. Short, long. Okay? And most English poets, many other poets have written in that, and it is not accidental that this predominates, because poetry is biological and we have iambs running in us all the time. Our heart does not beat with equal beats. Our heart, the center of our being, that pulse that keeps us alive, is quite literally iambic. Short, long, short, long, short, long, short, long. Shall I compare thee to a summer's day? Thou art more lovely and more temperate. Okay? That pulse is going through our body all the time. Poets are aware of those natural rhythms inside us and outside of us, and can use them. There is, if you will, as part of life, as part of God's creation, that rhythmic network of beating hearts, singing birds, the rhythm of water flowing in a stream. We are surrounded by rhythms. Poets hear those rhythms, understand the profound way they can move us, and are able to match words to them to generate a beautiful, descriptive, intelligent, insightful vision of who we are, why we're here, and where we're going, and lift us up for a moment. Poetry uplifts. Even a bleak poem, such as The Wasteland, uplifts. Because poetry in itself, by virtue of what it is uplifting. The other thing it is, of course, is it may just be pure sound. And the sounds of poetry can be lovely, even if we don't know what they're saying. Let me take an example from English, but from an English that we don't use regularly. It's bygone English, if you will. And it will lead us into The Wasteland. One of the great medieval poets, Geoffrey Chaucer, who wrote in what was called Middle English, appropriately because it's the middle ground between Old English and what we speak today. And while eventually, if you spend some time with it, you can get to it, basically our ears are not attuned. Let me recite for you the very opening of the Canterbury Tales. You're not going to know everything it means, but listen to the sounds. Because the sounds are working on you. The arrangement of sounds in and of itself possesses a beauty, even if you're not quite aware what it is that he's talking about. Okay? I've chosen this deliberately because Eliot is playing off this passage as he opens The Wasteland. Opening of the general prologue to the Canterbury Tales. Wan that Apru with his shore is sota, the drucht of March hath persed to the rota, and bathed every vine in switch liqueur, of which virtue engendered is the floor. Wan that Zephyrus ache with his sway to breath, in spirit hath in every hold and haith the tondra cropes, and the younger sonna hath in the rom his halve course erona, and smaller fool and mark and melodia, that sleepen all the nicht with open ear. So pricketh him nature in her carages, than long and folk to gone on pilgrimages, and palmers for to sake and strongest thrones, from fairna hallways, couth in sondre londes, and specially from every shearer's ender of Engoland to Canterbury they wenda, the holy blissful martyr for to sake, that Ham hath holp on when that they were sake. It's gorgeous stuff. It's absolutely gorgeous stuff. And occasionally a word will hit, right? Occasionally you get a little phrase, but you don't really have to know what it's saying. Because there's rhythm there, there's music, there's sound there. It's something beautiful. And what you get from it is there is design, there is order, there is beauty. And poetry will do that. At the same time, it has meaning. But part of the meaning of poetry is carried in the beauty of the sound. We are not being fair to the poet or the poetry if we take every detail of it and say, what does it mean? What does it mean? What does it mean? I don't understand this. Explain that. Explain. Okay. That's our technical mind at work. Give me an answer. Finish that equation. Okay. Balance that out for me. I don't understand this. I got to understand it. Boy, you know, it's the American mentality, and that's the reason why my students say, well, it's got hidden meaning. It's got hidden meaning. I don't want to work to have to find out what it means. And you say to them, you don't always have to know what it means. What do you mean I don't have to know what it means? It can just sound pretty. Reject that out of hand. Well, the fact of the matter is poetry does sound. And sound can be meaning in ways that touch us in the heart, in the rhythm, profoundly in ways we don't know. At the same time, it will tell us things. It is of the intellect. The best poetry does both. But we can't separate them. We can't just look at one and pretend it's just one. Or it's just the other. It's a unity. It's a unity. In the same way that as we are natural creatures and supernatural creatures. And we can't be divided. You rip us apart and you just focus on the one and you're not getting the truth of what it is to be human. You rip poetry apart and just look at the meaning without the beauty of the rhythm and the sound and what's and the arrangement of syllables and you're only getting half of poetry and you're not really getting what it is. What this means, though, is a great poem has to be lived with. The same way a great piece of music has to be lived with. You take one of the Beethoven piano sonatas, and the first time you hear it, the ear is just going through it, trying to make its way through this succession of sounds. And it might be kind of nice, and oh, that was pleasant, but anybody who says on a first hearing, oh, well, yes, that's a great piece of music, and I understand that. Come on. It doesn't work that way, because the thing is too complicated. But after the second hearing, the third hearing, or the fourth, or after you've lived with the piece for 5 years, 10 years, when you come back to it, not having heard it for a while, but it's in your blood in a way, and suddenly the piece just opens up, because suddenly you're flowing with it. It's a part of you. Poetry is that way. Great poetry has to be read over and over and over and over again to get a sense of what it's doing. And most importantly, it's got to be memorized. You've got to put some of it in your head. One, it's good mental discipline, but the other thing is that's the only way you can get to really know a poem. And that's the reason why, in years gone by, in grade schools, part of education was just memorizing poetry. That wasn't just a meaningless exercise, and that wasn't just discipline. That was, if you will, fertilizing the soul of young people and giving them something that they could hold on to for years to come, and the longer they lived with it, the more it would be there. My dear friend Clara Lund, I mentioned earlier, in her 80s, could sit, I timed her once, and recite things she had learned in third, fourth, and fifth grade, and she went on for 2.5 hours without repeating anything. Much of it was poetry. And it was because all of those, occasionally a word would drop out here or there, but what she had still was the rhythm. She remembered it was there. And she would say, oh, I can sit, I can just sit and entertain myself. Just I run through it. It's not accidental. We've denied that to our children. It's not accidental. In denying them the chance to put that up here and let those words flow, words of beauty and good sense flow through them, we have, it's another way in which we've been drying up their souls. We've not given the moisture necessary. We've not given the rain. The rain hasn't come, nothing could grow, and we're back at the beginning of the wasteland again. Chaucer takes us to the wasteland. My image of nothing being able to grow because there's no rain takes us to the wasteland. The wasteland, for good or ill, has been acclaimed as the poem of the century, and there's truth there. May God help us. But we have a great poet who was telling the truth. And it begins with the title. And the title alone begins to give us a sense of where we are. The land has been laid waste. Waste. In choosing the title, Eliot knew what he was doing. But this is his second title. There was an earlier title that in a way helps us to understand the poem. The Wasteland's a better title for the poem. The first title gives us a better clue as to what's going on in the poem. The original title of the poem was He Do the Police in Different Voices. He Do the Police in Different Voices. It's a reference. It's a quotation. It's from a magnificent Dickens novel called Our Mutual Friend. Some of us know it as the Champagne of Dickens. It was the last completed Dickens novel. There's a character in the book called Sloppy, who's sort of a tall, lanky, doy-doy-doy-doy-doy kind of guy. Very, very nice fellow. Very, very good-hearted character in the book. And every night he buys the newspaper and takes it to this elderly couple's house and he reads the newspaper to them because they're old and their eyes are bad and they can't read. So Sloppy buys the paper and takes it to them and he reads the paper. And the woman is telling her friend about how kind Sloppy is and how every night he comes and he buys the newspaper and he brings the newspaper to them and he reads all the stories to them, especially he reads to them aloud the crime stories and He Do the Police in Different Voices. It's a wonderful little joke. But it's the way the whole poem works. Because Eliot is giving us the modern world in different voices. In a whole series of different voices. Why is this important? Well, it's important for a number of reasons because it was an enormous change in a poetic tradition. It was a break, a seeming break with a poetic tradition. And yet, Eliot's the man who wrote the most influential essay on poetry in our time called Tradition and the Individual Talent. It's an essay about the poet, poetry, and how the artist works. Tradition and the Individual Talent. And in the poem, Eliot says, any artist has an obligation to go back and study those artists that preceded him. You cannot pretend to be a master of your art or understand what you're doing if you don't go back into the past and have a thorough knowledge of what those who came before you did. And then he makes the other claim that if you do that, you will be able to find your own voice. But if you attempt to simply sit down, I'm inspired. The muses have moved me. Give me paper. Give me pen. I am now going to write a masterpiece. My students do this all the time. They bring them in. Sir, I wondered if you'd take a look at this. I was in my room last night, and it just came to me. And I'll leave it here so you'll have some time to look at it. And, you know, I'm going, oh, please. And I'm trying to be polite, and I say, well, yeah, then, so then I sit down and read this stuff. Oh, man, oh, you know, it's like the young husband sitting down and eating his wife's first meal when she's never cooked before, right? And say, and how is it, dear? He says, oh, it's wonderful. So that you can't discourage the students. I mean, I can't say to them, this is just awful. Please promise me you'll never attempt anything like this again. It's not fair to do it. It's not fair to do it. You say, well, you know, this is really very interesting, but, you know, I think you might want to take a poetry course. I think there's some technical problems here that if you went back and study, I think you could overcome. But really, it's deep and meaningful. Yes, I know that. I was moved as I wrote it. And then I close the door and roll around on the floor going, ah! And hope it's just a venial sin. Although there are times when I suspect encouraging bad poetry may sneak into a more serious category. But the point being, if you're going to do anything original, you have to know the heritage. And original does not necessarily mean new, revolutionary. It simply means that which is your own. I cannot become the best at what I hope to do. I cannot know who I am unless I know what went before. And I don't have to tell this group about tradition and the importance of tradition or the way in which that then frees you. It is not, as they say, a chain. It doesn't bind you up. It defines you. And it allows then that genuine freedom to be fully that self that God created. That's what Eliot's essay is about. So that Eliot is often called a revolutionary poet. The Wasteland was a revolution in poetry. He would reject that term. The Wasteland came after years of hard study, in which he studied the poetry, that studied English poetry, studied French poetry, studied Latin poetry, studied the Greeks. This is another reason there aren't great artists now. We're not teaching anybody anything. He had studied and studied and studied, and he spent a lot of time thinking and thinking and thinking, and a lot of time looking around him, and he wouldn't put anything down until he had something to say. But he did make a change, and what he realized was that so-called tradition that had preceded him, which was the tradition of romantic poetry, was dead, dry and dead, is the world in which he lived. And it had to go. Because it was no longer alive, it was no longer true. Those poets, I was going to bring a copy, I forgot, but I make it tomorrow night. Some of the, God rest their souls, the poor young men, some of those young men going into World War I, who had some talent, writing poetry about the honor and the nobility and the glory of going off to fight in World War I. No. That was created up here. That was an attempt to hold on to something that might have existed in the past, but it wasn't there then. It was finally not true. And Eliot knew it wasn't true. And crawling out the other end of the war, when all that had been blown to pieces, he realized that those voices who had written those things had been lying. It wasn't true. Something had happened. There was something new in the air. Any poet who had to be truthful had to capture whatever that was new, that was there, and it didn't have to do with romance and glory and honor and nobility, because this century, the century that had just been born, had blown all that to pieces. Curiously, the Romantics had claimed that the individual was the center of the universe. The Romantic poets had claimed that the individual voice of the poet was the legislator of the time, the defining element in the world out there. Poets are the legislators of their age. The poet, the romantic poet, can define for the world out there what the world is like by asserting his own personality, by sending forth his own voice. The first thing that Eliot did, by the way, that continues. That phony romantic tradition couldn't hide in poetry anymore after Eliot. Eliot beat it to death. It went into pop music, where it survives today. And very sadly, you have that continuation of that whole rock tradition. I am the center of the universe. I define everything in terms of myself. The whole world should come to me and I'll explain it all to the world. I am everything. I am everything, and I'll tell you about it. Listen to me sing. Listen to my poem. Listen to my song. It's dead. It's in rock music now. It's Kurt Cobain. He's a corpse. He's in the wasteland. He didn't know it. He didn't know how he got there. That phony tradition continues. Eliot, in the early years of the century, knew that was gone. It was a lie. It was phony. He knew that no individual voice could do that anymore. He somehow knew something had happened to us, and in spite of all his brilliance, all his talent, all his study, he didn't dare put out his own voice because it wasn't strong enough. No one voice could sum up what had happened. Or, let me put it another way, the individual had been fragmented. Not only had society blown up in World War I, not only had the society become totally fragmented, so had the individual. And for any individual artist to pretend, I am here, I am whole, I will now explain the world to you, is a lie because we live in an age where that's no longer possible in art. How can it be done? The individual is fragmented. The individual doesn't know who he is. The artist doesn't know what his voice is. Who can understand what's happening? What's going on here? How did this happen? What's happened? What does it mean? I don't know. I can't know. But maybe, given the fragmentation, if I take a poem and smash it to bits and fragment it, maybe through the pieces of different voices, one against the other, I can discover something. And in this poem, we very rarely hear Eliot's own voice. We hear all sorts of other voices. It is a poem of many, many voices in which, if you will, you can think of it this way. In some ways, it's a dramatic poem, not just in terms of the drama of what it's talking about. It's a dramatic poem in that the poet keeps taking on disguises. He keeps putting on masks. He suddenly becomes one character, then he becomes another character, then he'll become somebody else. And it's constantly shifting. In the way the poem is written, there's not solid ground for us to stand on. We can't know for very long whose voice is speaking to us without it suddenly shifting. And every voice, the utterance of every individual soul, has its own rhythms. So that the rhythms of the poem are constantly changing. The imagery in the poem is constantly changing. It seems as if there's no center. It seems as if there's nowhere to stand. It seems as if we can't. What's going on here? And it's the reason why the first response to the poem is just bewilderment. Absolute bewilderment. And then he complicates it by doing one other thing. He goes back to that poetic tradition he had studied. And what he realized was that great poetic tradition, from the Greeks, through Virgil, through Dante, through Chaucer, through Shakespeare, up through the 19th century that had just drawn to a close, everything that represented, all of Western civilization, that tradition that stretched back from the Bible and the Greeks all the way up to the present day, had just blown up. It was gone. It had been destroyed. And in the same way, if you want to think of it as a gigantic building that had been built over 25 centuries, if all of a sudden, it happened to the Parthenon, okay? Imagine, if you will, there was a time the Parthenon on the Acropolis was absolutely complete and whole and beautiful. There it stood. And then, in the midst of a war, they blew it up. And now there are great chunks of it missing. There are whole pieces of it that are gone. Think of it, if you will, as them going to Chartres Cathedral. And don't think this couldn't happen. It could happen any day. Terrorist bombers get inside and blow Chartres Cathedral to pieces. And then they move on up to London. And they go to St. Paul's Cathedral and they blow that to pieces. And then they go down to Sydney, Australia, and they blow up the new Sydney Opera House. And all the buildings of Western civilization have all been blown to pieces. And think of Eliot as an archaeologist who sails around the Western world and picks up little pieces. Oh, here's a chunk of the Parthenon. This was a little horse's head that was up there on that frieze up there. And look. Here's a fragment of an angel from Chartres Cathedral. Look at that. Remember what we were? Remember the glory of this tradition? I'm saving a few pieces of it because that's all that's left. And that's what he does in the poem. He takes all that went before, the great poems, the great visions, and he knows, quite literally, they were blown up. And he's grabbing little bits of them and reminding us what it was, where we came from, the glory that existed there. And now he's trying to, if you will, almost jigsaw puzzle-like, put them back together and hold on to what's left to try to give a new vision. Is it possible to save anything? I refer you to the very end of the poem. I'm in part 5, What the Thunder Said. We come to the end of the poem. The last 10 lines is doing this. There are a few lines by Eliot, but we get lines from a children's song. We get lines from Dante's Purgatorio. We get lines from Greek mythology. We get a line from a sonnet by Gerard de Nerval. We get a line from Thomas Kidd's Elizabethan tragedy called The Spanish Tragedy. We get fragments of Eastern mystical prayer, and he shoves them all together. All of a sudden, at the end of the poem, we're all over the place. Just quotation, 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 quotation. But in the midst of it, notice what he says. And this is Eliot. Line 431, if you've got the lines there. These fragments I have shored against my ruins. These fragments I have shored against my ruins. I'm trying to save little bits of it. I'm trying to hold on to something. It had great value. I'm trying to put it back together. I'm trying to preserve it by putting it back together in a new way. In the same way that in the Dark Ages, what are called the Dark Ages, okay, when it was clear that there was going to be a long, difficult time before the faith was really going to blossom, they would quite literally save the clippings of saints' nails, okay? They would save that and hold on to it, knowing that someday in the future that would have meaning again. That was something worth saving and preserving because it was holy. And Eliot is saying, this is the tradition of Western poetry. This is the tradition of Western art. This is what I learned. This is what I love. This is where I came from. This is everything that I have known. I'll hold on to what I can. But it's fragments. It's fragments. But what glorious fragments, and they are not arranged accidentally. There is this extraordinary perceptive intelligence that's putting them in a certain order. Now, part of what you can do with the poem, and I'm not going to do it, because if we were doing a course in the wasteland, we'd start doing some of this. Taking each one of those lines, where does it come from? Why is it here? How does it connect with what went before and what came after? It's like a mosaic. Why is it placed in this position? What's the larger? That takes hard work. It takes hard work to understand why he did it. It took a lot more work to put it in the right place and turn it into something new, original, and beautiful. But that intelligence took those fragments and made something new and something beautiful and something memorable out of it. Something that said something that speaks to us, even now, because it's our age. And part of what it's saying, and I want to emphasize this in spite of the despair of the poem, and I'm going to turn to that, in spite of the darkness of this poem, you have a creative imagination that is looking at the ruins and saying, there may not be much left, but I'm going to take what is left and turn it into something that is new, comprehensible, and beautiful in its own right. It is the refusal of the poet to give up the game. And he is quite literally preserving what's there and reminding us of what's there.